Hey there, Inklings, and welcome back to Catawampus Readings, the podcast where beginnings and introductions are ruthlessly slaughtered with their own swords. Today, we're looking at a book that made half the world lose its mind a few years back when everyone I knew was calling the author the new Tolkien. I am, of course, referring to A Game of Thrones, the first book in the A Song of Ice and Fire series by George R.R. Martin. There are a few things I would say about this man and this series, but I think I can keep most of my opinions to myself as we look at the beginning, just the beginning of the first book, examining it for its deftness in introducing the setting, the characters, and of course, the conflict. For any of you that have been living under a rock for the last several years, or otherwise don't pay any attention to fantasy titles, here's the summary of Game of Thrones from the book's back cover. Long ago, in a time forgotten, a preternatural event threw the seasons out of balance. In a land where summers can last decades and winters a lifetime, trouble is brewing. The cold is returning, and in the frozen wastes to the north of Winterfell, sinister and supernatural forces are massing beyond the kingdom's protective wall. At the center of the conflict lie the Starks of Winterfell, a family as harsh and unyielding as the land they were born to. Sweeping from a land of brutal cold to a distant summertime kingdom of Epicurean plenty, here is a tale of lords and ladies, soldiers and sorcerers, assassins and bastards, who come together in a time of grim omens. Here, an enigmatic band of warriors bear swords of no human metal. A tribe of fierce wildlings carry men off into madness. A cruel young dragon prince barters his sister to win back his throne. And a determined woman undertakes the most treacherous of journeys. Amid plots and counterplots, tragedy and betrayal, victory and terror, the fate of the Starks, their allies, and their enemies hangs precariously in the balance as each endeavors to win the deadliest of conflicts, the Game of Thrones. Can I give this teaser a 6 out of 5? Am I allowed to do that? Keeping in mind that the summary from the back of the book isn't actually intended to summarize, but rather to convince the person holding the book that they really want to read it, this does an absolutely top-notch job. Reading this out loud makes me feel like the impressive announcer for, you know, movie trailers, am I right? In a world ruled by darkness, one man stands against the tide of evil. That kind of thing. It's a real thrill. I do wonder sometimes if we're not taking this whole trend a little too far. You know, using action and ever-increasing pace to compensate for short modern attention spans. I'm not in a position to comment on it, really, since I am one of those people with short attention spans, but I wonder. So, to keep in mind what we're looking for, let's do a quick review. An introduction, no matter what the medium, should do at least one of three things. Introduce the main character or characters, describe the world in which the story will take place, and reveal the conflict that the story seeks to resolve. Most modern introductions will handle two of the three, sometimes endeavor to get all three at once, which can be a little overwhelming, but if well done, it can be extremely effective. Now, I'm not going to go into how the show compares to the books or what they could have done better or any of that nonsense, because if you wanted all that, you would be watching a think piece on YouTube, not listening to a literary podcast about beginnings and introductions. I will say, however, that the story lends itself remarkably well to a Marxist reading, which we'll touch on after we get into the book itself. So, without further ado, let's dig in. A Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. Prologue.
"We should start back," Garrett urged, as the woods began to grow dark around them. "The wildlings are dead."
"Do the dead frighten you?" Sir Waymer Royce asked, with just a hint of a smile.
Garrett did not rise to the bait. He was an old man, past 50, and he had seen lordlings come and go.
"Dead is dead," he said. "We have no business with the dead."
Are they dead? Royce asked softly.
What proof do we have?
Will saw them, Garrett said. If he says they're dead, that's proof enough for me.
Will had known they would drag him into their quarrel sooner or later. He wished it had been later rather than sooner.
My mother told me that dead men sing no songs, he put in.
My wet nurse said the same thing, Will, Royce replied. Never believe anything you hear at a woman's knee. There are things to be learned even from the dead.
His voice echoed, too loud in the twilight forest.
We have a long ride ahead of us, Garrett pointed out. 8 days, maybe 9. The night is falling.
Sir Waymer Royce glanced at the sky with disinterest.
It does that every day about this time.
Are you unmanned by the dark, Garrett?
Will could see the tightness around Garrett's mouth, the barely suppressed anger in his eyes under the thick black hood of his cloak. Garrett had spent 40 years in the Night's Watch, man and boy, and he was not accustomed to being made light of. Yet it was more than that. Under the wounded pride, Will could sense something else in the older man. You could taste it. A nervous tension that came perilous close to fear. Will shared his unease. He had been 4 years on the wall. The first time he had been sent beyond, all the old stories had come rushing back and his bowels had turned to water. He had laughed about it afterward. He was a veteran of 100 rangings by now, and the endless dark wilderness that the Southron called the Haunted Forest held no more terrors for him. Until tonight. Something was different tonight. There was an edge to this darkness that made his hackles rise. 9 days they had been riding, north and northwest, and then north again, farther and farther from the wall, hard on the track of a band of wildling raiders. Each day had been worse than the day that had come before, and today was the worst of all. A cold wind was blowing out of the north, and it made the trees rustle like living things. All day, Will had felt as though something were watching him, something cold and implacable that loved him not. Garrett had felt it too. Will wanted nothing so much as to ride hell-bent for the safety of the wall, but that was not a feeling to share with your commander. Especially not a commander like this. Sir Waymar Royce was the youngest son of an ancient house with too many heirs. He was a handsome youth of 18, gray-eyed and graceful, and as slender as a knife. Mounted on his huge black destrier, the knight towered above Will and Garrett on their smaller garrons. He wore black leather boots, black woolen pants, black moleskin gloves, and a fine, supple coat of gleaming black ringmail over layers of black wool and boiled leather. Sir Waymer had been a sworn brother of the Night's Watch for less than half a year, but no one could say he had not prepared for his vocation, at least insofar as his wardrobe was concerned. His cloak was his crowning glory, sable, thick and black and soft as sin.
Bet he killed them all himself, he did, Garrett told the barracks over wine. Twisted their little heads off, our mighty warrior.
And they had all shared the laugh. It's hard to take orders from a man you laughed at in your cups, Will reflected, as he sat shivering atop his garron.
Garrett must have felt the same. Mormont said we should track them, and we did. Garrett said. They're dead. They shan't trouble us no more. There's hard riding before us, and I don't like this weather. If it snows, we could be a fortnight getting back, and snow's the best we could hope for. Ever seen an ice storm, my lord?
The lordling seemed not to hear him. He studied the deepening twilight in a half-bored, half-distracted way.
Will had ridden with the knight long enough to understand that it was best not to interrupt him when he looked like that.
Tell me again what you saw, Will. All the details. Leave nothing out.
Will had been a hunter before he'd joined the Night's Watch. Well, a poacher, in truth. Malister free riders had caught him red-handed in the Malister's own woods, skinning one of the Malister's own bucks, and it had been a choice of putting on the black or losing a hand. No one could move through the woods as silent as Will, and it had not taken the Black Brothers long to discover his talent.
I'm going to just mention here that I did censor a single word in the reading that we just finished, as this series is adult in nature and not suited to younger readers. I don't think the use of crass language on its own is necessarily a bad thing in literature, so much as I believe that there are less crass ways of handling those particular story elements. Among other things, it's a good sign if your introduction gives the feeling of the scope of your story. Is this a big story, a small story, or somewhere in between? This can be read in the number of named characters that are introduced in the beginning stretch, how big the world feels in the descriptions of the landscape and the weather, and in smaller details like where cloth comes from, or a specific house's banner, or the rarity of a certain type of fruit. Any of these things can be communicated to the reader, or the viewer, or the player, and that can say there's more to this story than what I can see in this one scene. That around that bend in the road, it's not just a painted backdrop, but there's more road, and the road leads somewhere. All of this probably seems vague and unhelpful as far as writing advice goes, and in a way, it absolutely is. Okay, so you want an introduction that makes the world feel big, but what does that even mean? In short, there should be enough detail provided that the reader knows there is more that they don't know. These men are part of the Night's Watch. They have a uniform and a command structure. The Northern Forest is called the Haunted Wood by people that live further south, and those living in the south trade stories about the terrors that wait in the north. We don't get to hear those stories, but we know they're there. The implication that these stories are well known is, I think, more effective than actually sharing the stories would have been on its own. There's a very delicate balance between giving enough detail for us to know there's more that we don't know, and giving us so much detail that it overwhelms the story with the world, or turns the world into set dressing for the soap opera that's about to march on stage. In this case, I think George R.R. Martin did a fantastic job of introducing a small group of characters, letting us glimpse the world that they live in, and hinting at the conflict that's going to haunt them for the next several books. Earlier, I mentioned that the book lends itself well to a Marxist reading. As we've been looking at literary criticism and how it's done, I thought we might wrap up that subject and this episode with a very brief Marxist analysis of the introduction of A Game of Thrones. Marxism, as some of you might already know, is a socioeconomic theory stating that everything that society calls its own, from its social classes to its aesthetics to its legal system, are all influenced or even dictated by the economics of that society. The most popular application of Marxism as a theory is to criticize capitalism, stating that it's the clash between those that own the goods, the bourgeoisie, and those that need the goods, the proletariat, that causes all social change, and that's not always in positive directions. In our introduction here, we can see the rich and powerful young commander, Sir Royce, dismissing the experience and knowledge of the poorer, less powerful soldiers under him. Just from what we've read today, one might draw the conclusion that the author is asserting, through Sir Royce's dismissal, that the bourgeoisie is weak, ineffective, and proud to the point of self-destruction. On the other hand, the author might be using Sir Royce's intelligence and calm poise as a way to communicate that the upper classes are necessary despite being unpleasant, since they have access to education that the proletariat lower classes might misuse or even ignore. That's only the briefest taste of what this delectable feast of literary criticism has to offer, but unfortunately, we're out of time, so that's all you're getting today. The random question of the day is, if you needed to come up with 4 categories for gifts, what would they be? Until next time, stay warm and dry, my Inklings. Winter is well and truly here, but the days are getting longer and soon the weather will remember there's something to it other than rain. This has been your host, Inkfire, and you have been a simply wonderful audience. I'll see you on the other side.